I brought my own battery. Can you hear me in the up there? No, you can't because I didn't have the battery in. Now how are we? No? Okay. Yes, you can hear me. No, you can't? Raise your hand if you can hear me. Okay, we're up to the middle of the... Well, let's try this. How am I doing now? Up there, can you? Yes, you can hear me. Yes? All right. Thank you. We're on. The news you've all been waiting to hear is that we will have the exams back on Wednesday. But boy, did I have fun on Saturday. So. Not grading your exams. Julie did her part. But I will. I promise. I will finish. And we will give them back in class on Wednesday, at the end of class on Wednesday. Questions? No? No? We were talking about cognitive I was talking about cognitive development. And so I'm going to continue to do that. I'm going to pick up essentially where I was, and I'm going to suggest I was described. Yes. Can I be a little bit louder? Louder or rowdy? I'll try. Does that help? Am I? No? No? How about that? No? Is that any better? Okay, nothing is happening here then with the volume. Is that correct? It's not getting any louder. Is it working at all? A little bit? Okay. I'm sorry. Best I can do with the equipment available at the moment. But I'll come up and stand beside you, then you'll be able to hear. How about that? No matter if you're a personal lecturer, you can have me. Right here. Okay. I'll split the difference. There we go. I'm sorry. Okay. I was trying to make the bridge between the biological and the intellectual on Wednesday. And so I'm going to continue that a little bit and play out some themes in development that... build that bridge and give us an idea of where we start intellectually. So the fundamental question I'm raising is, what does a baby come into the world with in the way of equipment and or knowledge that will lead to the development of the kind of intelligence that we expect humans to have? And one of the very important concepts is that we have the kind of intelligence that we have, and we have the intellectual skills that we have because we have the brains that we have. This knowledge and thinking and intelligence are based on the functioning of that biological organ. And the brain is designed to process particular types of information. That's true of all species. If you look at wood ticks, for example, they have very, very primitive little brains, but they process, they detect and process through their receptors some very simple information about verticality. Is something going up compared to gravity, which pulls them down. They can detect changes in temperature within a small range. And they can detect carbon dioxide. So what does a wood tick do with that information? Wood tick is a very simple and very stupid little insect, but it survives by using the information that it can acquire and by responding to it in a essentially pre-programmed way. What happens with the wood tick is that it crawls along the ground after it hatches until it finds something that is vertical, and it climbs up that. And if you've evolved in the woods or in grassland, what you're going to find that's vertical is probably a plant. And if you climb up that plant for a certain distance and then find something that isn't vertical and crawl, which now means you're going horizontal, you're going out to the end of a twig or a branch. And then you hang there. Life is very dull for wood ticks. I used to work in Pittsburgh with a biologist who studied wood ticks, among other things. Life is very dull for wood ticks. But when they detect carbon dioxide and a slight rise in temperature, they let go of whatever they're hanging on. And every once in a while, when they do that, they fall onto a warm-blooded animal, because warm-blooded animals are what produce carbon dioxide and an increase in temperature. And they burrow down into the, crawl down into the fur, and then they bite. And they dig themselves in under the skin, and then they drink blood. And then they drop off and go through the reproductive cycle again. If they don't land on something that's warm and furry, then they fall off. They hit the ground, they shake themselves, I suppose, and then they look for something else to climb up. If you look at any species of organism, it has a nervous system that responds to particular kinds of input and uses that input to direct its life. And in simple organisms, that means that you have some kind of instinctive response to changes in CO2 level or in temperature, movement of a particular kind, which tells a snake where its prey is and where it might find it, all different kinds of input that lets you get food and maintain life. Humans are a species that have evolved quite successfully, and we're just like all the others, except more complex. Our brains are complex, and we process several different kinds of information. We don't, in fact, detect the same kinds of things that wood ticks do. So you don't detect a slight increase in CO2 level in your environment. You don't detect small increases in temperature. You don't detect ultraviolet light as insects do. You've seen the movies where they convert the ultraviolet light so that you can see the patterns in flowers and plants that insects see that attract them. You have different kinds of eyes than insects, but you do detect within what we arrogantly call visible light, visible to us, we mean, we detect that and we detect patterns within it and we use those patterns. As the brain has evolved, it has developed very broad potentials to detect information that is going to be useful to human beings. And we detect in several different modes. There are lots of different things that we can detect, and there are many things that we can't. All of the things that we do detect have some connection to our survival. One of the reasons that human beings have been so successful in surviving is that we're not dependent on our instinctive reactions to information that we get. Our brains are complex and they allow us to continue to acquire experience, and I use the term schemas, Wednesday, we detect familiar patterns, but we can represent those patterns, which means we have memory. And as we remember patterns, we can also process them, we can put them together, we can integrate them into bigger patterns, which means that there is essentially no limit to the complexity of the information that we can create, the knowledge that we can create, because our brains are big enough to process the experience that we have over a lifetime and continue to make more complex sense of it. At the beginning, our potentials are very broad, and this is one of the examples that the book describes. Infants, in the first few months, can detect and distinguish all of the phonemes, the specific sounds, that are used in any human language. So it doesn't matter what language they're going to speak, they can process the sounds of all of them, all of the known languages, you know, 5,000 or so. 8,000 we used to have before we started dying off. And infants can produce all of those sounds. So all of those sounds that are used in languages that you don't speak, and some of you have tried to learn some of those sounds. Remember the German R? How many of you have wrestled with the German? And the French R. Can you hear the distinction between the French R and the German R? And the English R? They're different. How many of you speak Tkung? Any of you from Africa speak Tkung? So, actually a group of languages that have clicks in them. And you learned to make those clicks when you were speaking English, right? Whole set of sounds, whole different set of sounds, variety that we don't use in English, but they are used in other languages. They're used in many other languages. And the only thing we can do in trying to write those languages is to put in an exclamation point, which is why when you see the name of one of the peoples of Africa written out, it's written exclamation point T-U-N-G. That the exclamation point represents a sound that you can't make. Well, you can make it, you can learn to make it. The problem is integrating it into all of the other phonemes that make up the words and the sentences of the language. Infants can make every one of those sounds. So infants have what we call linguistic omnipotentiality. They can hear it all, and they can produce it all, and any infant, no matter where it's born, no matter who its parents are, has the potential to learn any spoken language. The kicker is that you have to start early. And most of us got our second languages in high school, because then that's when we're real smart. Unfortunately, after you go through puberty, your ability to learn to speak and to distinguish the specific sounds of any language is greatly reduced. That's the second major reduction. Adolescence comes with a cost. The ability to reproduce comes with a cost, and the cost is being able to learn languages naturally. But even in infancy and toddlerhood, the possibilities are narrowed by experience. The problem is that you gradually distinguish and produce the sounds of the language that you are hearing, and you lose the ability to distinguish and produce those that you don't hear around you. And that loss begins as you start to try to imitate the language that's being spoken around you. So those of us who grow up in monolingual households where both of our parents speak the same language and only one language very rapidly lose the ability to even detect differences in phonemes in other languages. And we lose, or gradually, we lose most of the ability to learn to produce those languages, those phonemes, within the context of spoken language, because we're focusing on the language that we're learning. So this might remind you of an analogy. Remember, in the brain, you had more synapses and more cells than you use. And through infancy, those synapses and cells that aren't used get pruned. They die off. And the ones that you use are consolidated, and the pathways are strengthened. The same thing is happening with, in this example, linguistic potential. The abilities that you're born with are pruned if you're not using them. And the trade-off is that you consolidate and strengthen the skills that you need to produce the language or languages that you're actually learning. The more languages you learn as a child, the more of that potential you maintain. So if you're growing up in a household with two or three or four languages and learning to speak all of them and to hear them all and understand them, you're keeping more of that potential alive, and it will actually make learning additional languages later in life easier. Those of us who grew up, as I said, monolingually have a very difficult time with second and third languages when we try to learn those, especially if we wait till after the second major decline, which is through puberty. So, the question that the text asks and other people often ask is, should I raise my child bilingually? The answer is clearly yes. And maybe trilingually, and maybe five or six. And what you'll find is that during the childhood years, oh, boy, I've got more volume back here. Ha! I'm supposed to stay here. That's the message. Don't go up in the audience. I'm supposed to, is that too loud up there? No, okay. Wow, maybe it's just that I've got speakers. Wow, I'm echoing. It's amazing. I've got speakers there. And probably it has to do with facing the receiver, wherever that is. Okay, back to the issues, which was during childhood, if you're learning two or three or four languages, you're likely to confound them. You'll learn them all as a single language, because that's what's happening when you're learning language naturally in childhood. You're just learning language, and you're not distinguishing the separate languages. But by the time you're four or five, if you have two or three languages, you will have figured out that there are different languages, and then gradually you'll separate the vocabularies and the grammar for each specific language. And then by the time you're five or six, you can switch effortlessly from one language to the other. And in high school, when you decide to learn a fourth or fifth, it'll be easier for you. Although it becomes more difficult if you don't use that potential to learn new languages. So you gradually lose it. My favorite demonstration of that was a professor that I had in college who was a linguist and had grown up in Europe, in Switzerland, and was fluent in four languages by the time he was off to school, elementary school. And so he became a linguist. He got fascinated by languages. And when I knew him, he was in his mid-30s, and his goal in life was to have fluency in at least one of the major languages of each of the major language groups in the world. And so every summer he would go off to wherever they spoke the language that he wanted to learn, and he would immerse himself in it. And when I was in college, he was working on number 17 and then 18 And he says very simple, if you go someplace and you don't know the language, but you have reasonable skill, you go sit in the coffee shops or drink with people. And you never use any of your other languages, and you make yourself known. And you drink enough, you have to go to the bathroom, you'll learn to say bathroom pretty quickly, if they have bathrooms in that culture. You will pick up the vocabulary and the grammar very quickly. Easy for him to say. For the rest of us, it might be a little more difficult. Okay, let me go this way. The brain receives information or stimuli in different modes. You have different senses, and you have several of them. So, from at least birth and probably before, you're detecting sound and movement, possibly texture, certainly smell, visual image after you're born, and you can create schemas, the familiar patterns in each of those. So visual patterns become familiar, so you can pick out mom's face compared to everybody else, smells, texture, human skin compared to blankets, movement, being rocked, being thrown, those are different sounds, and there are probably more. This is not an exhaustive list. And as you create those schemas or patterns, you're able to elaborate them and integrate them through experience and practice. So the more visual experience you have of looking at things and distinguishing them, the bigger, as your brain develops, the bigger the visual patterns and the longer the visual sequences that you can store and represent and think about. As we develop, we're getting more complex information that we're creating. So you take the visual image and movements and smell, you're probably developing something about emotional relationship, emotional expressions of other people. As you become conscious or aware of having a self, of being a person separate from the rest of the world, you begin to develop knowledge of yourself, awareness of your own experience. We develop more complex number relationships, language, musical patterns. So what we're doing with our brain is taking in the information that's available to us, and we're creating schemas, and those schemas are becoming more complex through development. That's what the developmental process of intelligence consists of. We're developing more complex schemas that we can integrate into more and more complex, and we become able to represent those schemas. And that means in part that we can remember the familiar patterns, we can call them to mind, and as we're doing that, we can also begin to represent them in other ways. A question? Number relations? The difference between 2 and 3? I'm sorry. Or 1 and 2? There's some interesting research recently. It's been published in the last couple of years about the fact that all cultures, apparently all languages that we know of, have the ability to refer to, as they have words for, the notion of 1 and the notion of 2 and the notion of 3, and beyond that, many languages don't distinguish. So they have a word for many, or some such concept that means anything bigger than 3. And that's interesting. And we have numbers, we have words for all the numbers up to infinity. We have created a system of linguistic patterns with words to represent them, to represent all the possible numbers. Wow. We can also represent addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, fractionation, and all those other things that they try to teach us in math. What do infants detect? What do infants detect? Can they tell the difference between one and two things? Sure enough, newborns can distinguish between one thing and two things. And the text describes some of the techniques for finding out. It's essentially a discrimination learning task. But if you start with just, can they detect the difference between one thing and two things, the answer is yes. And infants can detect the difference between two and three. And they can detect more than three. Huh. So here we have languages in some cultures that can represent one, two, three, and more. And that seems to be what infants can detect. So, one of the speculative interpretations of that is the brain is wired to the eyes so that one and two are processed differently and different from three, and beyond three, we don't get it initially. Eventually, we do. Question arises, do we get it more than three because our language can refer to four and five? So if we hear the language four and five, does that make the concept of four or five or six important? What is the relationship between the initial ability of the brain, which is very clear, oneness, two-ness, three-ness, and more, and then is further development of that ability dependent on the language, on hearing the language? What is it that we count? How do we develop counting? And in our Western cultures, counting and being able to extend our number understanding is very important to us. In other cultures, it's not. And in cultures where it's not important, there may not be a word for it. So you don't learn the word until you go to some setting where it becomes important whether you have seven cows or nine. And you have to distinguish that. Let me give you another example that suggests the distinction between what the brain can do and the importance of language for consolidating that knowledge. And this is also research from the last two or three years. I probably should turn the lights on and put it on the board. Okay. Here are some things. I'm just going to draw them, but this is a flower vase, and it's got a really fat stem that really is jammed in there tightly. It's probably not even a flower, it's probably a broccoli. But it's jammed down in there real tight. Here's a teacup, and in it, there's a spoon rattling around. And here's a glass, and There's a straw in it. One of those. And I don't know what this is, but whatever is in it pretty much fills it up. It's a little loose. It's not jammed in there. How are the two on the right different from the two on the left? Yes. The amount of space around the object, the internal object, the object that's inside. Okay. The amount of available space. Another way of describing it? The difference between the two on the right and the two on the left. Yes. Closed and open. Okay. The fit. Okay. And pursuing the engineering connection, how do you describe the difference in fit? Okay. Big clearance, force fit, tolerance?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So there are ways to describe the difference in relationship between the internal object and the thing it's in, and there are several different ways to do it. If you look at 4 and 5 month old infants, no language yet, they can detect the difference between those two groups of objects. Okay. You give them a whole array of them. They can sort them. They can learn to suck when they're seeing the loose-fitting things and not suck when they're seeing the tight-fitting things because they're not getting any milk when they suck with the tight-fitting, and they can switch back and forth. And the difference is clearly perceived. And the people who study it say that the brain is processing the relationship between the two objects. And they're seeing it as loose and tight, or some such word like that. The particular experiment was done with babies in Korea and babies in the United States, and it's been reproduced in other cultures. The reason the researchers picked Korea, any of you speak Korean? Good, I can say anything I want about Korean. When I asked you to describe the difference, you had to search for a way to represent that difference linguistically. It's tight, it's loose. There are several different ways we can do it. The Korean language very specifically describes and refers to objects according to the degree of tightness of the fit. It has modifications of the words. It has a grammatical rule for forming the words that refers to whether or not they are loosely fitted or tightly fitted. So the word changes depending on whether it's describing something that is tight or loose. It's an important distinction in Korean linguistically. And Korean kids learn to make that distinction in their grammar very early on. So anyone who speaks Korean could tell us the difference using that commonly accepted distinction in Korean. The babies, Korean and American, detected the difference. If you do a learning experiment with Korean-speaking college students in Korea, they learn, based on that distinction, very quickly. If you do a learning experiment based on that distinction with American students, they ignore it. With English speakers, they ignore the distinction. That distinction was present when they were infants, but it's not reinforced by the English language. It's not a distinction that is important in our grammar. It's not even represented there. We have to make up phrases to describe it. The fact that it is present in the language on a daily basis makes that distinction important. But the babies don't have to learn the distinction. They already know it. And then they attach language to it if they're Korean, or they don't if they're learning English. And since in English you don't refer to it, it's obviously not important, so you pretty much forget about it. When I call it to your attention, you can figure that out. But if I give it to you without calling it to your attention, and in some of the tasks I'm asking you to figure out the difference between red and blue, and others it's between three things and two things, and tall and short, all of those you would have, but the distinction between tight and loose, you would be trying to figure out how to do this. The fact that I pointed it out to you makes it salient, but for a Korean student doing the same learning task, it's as important as the difference between red and blue. The difference between two and three. It's just there, and they do much better on that particular part of the task. What both of those bits of research suggest is that the brain is designed to make all kinds of distinctions and to notice all kinds of characteristics of reality and experience, and then we learn to represent them. And if we learn to represent the distinctions or the similarities or the characteristics that we're observing, if we learn to represent them, then they become important to us and we can think about them. If we don't, they may lose their importance. Or they may be among the many things that are important to us that we can't represent. In the previous slide, I said that one of the things that we detect is smell. Tell me in words the difference in smell between your partner and your brother. Okay. How many of you have a partner? Okay. We'll do this experiment. Okay, some of you are intimate with partners, right? Or have been. Okay? So a few of you are, right? How many of you also have a brother? Do they smell different? Okay. Any of you have a lover, partner who smells just like your brother? I think she resents that. Okay. You didn't see the hand in the back, right? But she made him put it down. So you know the difference in their smells, right? And you know people that smell inappropriate. You might like them, they might be interesting people, but they don't smell right. They don't smell attractive to you. It's fascinating. You all know this. You all know that when we say that love is based on chemistry, we're talking about odor, fragrance, smell. You all know it. You all know people who smell bad to you. And you wonder, how can somebody love him or her? There's no accounting for taste or for smell in human relationships. But we don't talk about it. And we have no words, no words to label fragrance of human bodies. And we know when they stink. We know when they smell fresh. We know what a baby smells like. But beyond that, you don't have a word. Well, it smells like Brian, or it smells like Laurie. But you don't have words beyond the association with the specific person. And even trying to talk about it makes us laugh. It's so fundamentally important. It's so familiar to us that we bump our nose against... No, I didn't intend to say that. We run up against a subject that we can't put into words that's really important, and it strikes us as funny. It is important. Here's a challenge for you. Find me a language that does describe smells, human smells. Somebody find me one and let me know that there is one, because I'll bet there is one. I'll bet there are some. But we don't in our language. So we don't represent smells linguistically, unless they're food smells, rotten eggs, but people smells, other than sweat socks, or a few other things we will not talk about. We don't represent them linguistically. When we can represent things linguistically, when we can represent these patterns, then we can connect them. And as we get older, we can connect across modalities, we can integrate them. And that ability to connect the things that we know and talk about them across modalities takes a big increase whenever there's a period of brain growth. Between 5 to 7, we get a big increase in our ability to describe and think about things in different modalities. And at puberty, as the brain changes, we begin to be able to see the similarities and differences among things, so we can compare the patterns that we're getting in these different areas, detect what's similar and what's different, and we can create analogies. Oh, well, that's sort of like what happens in some other content area. It's like, it's a simile, it's similar. And we'll look at some analogies later in this unit. Okay, what does he mean by represent something? In your notebook, get ready. This is a task. You got your pen. You're ready to go. Watch closely. Very closely. That's a stick. It is also a dowel, which is a particular kind of stick. It's a dowel. It's a hardwood dowel. I'm going to do something with it, and I would like you to draw what happens to the stick. Ready? Watch carefully. Draw what happened. Got it? Show it to your neighbor. And then I'd like six of you to come to the board and draw what you drew in your notebook. Just do it. Just stand up, walk down, draw what you drew. There's one, two, three, four, five. Nobody from the middle of the room. Very interesting. Go. Is there enough chalk?
Okay.
Brand new piece of chalk, and you can even eat it if you'd like. Okay, don't go too far.
Don't go too far. Awesome. Okay.
Yes. Don't go too far. We may need to ask you questions. Okay, thank you. Big hand for all the volunteers. Now, did you all see the same thing? Just not too far. Just be ready to answer questions. Okay, you all saw the same thing, and they all represented it. Okay. Are the drawings all the same? I'm going to have to put some more light on this one. Ah, okay. You may not be able to see that, but you got the whole thing in there. I need to put on a little weight. Yeah. Okay, the stick, and then 45-degree angle with a dotted line and an arrow that points that way, and then another arrow, and then it's solid here. Why the dotted line at the 45-degree angle? Whose was that? Why the dotted line? To show that it's going in that direction. Okay? Do you all understand that? Okay. It's a convention that when you draw something in an intermediate state, that you make it dotted. I don't know why, but we all understand it. So, you represented it before I dropped it. You represented it in its final state. Now, how do we know that there weren't two sticks? Did you see two sticks? No. Beginning state, arrows to represent the direction, and then the final state. And a dotted line to indicate that, to represent that, that's an intermediate state. Did you actually see it at 45 degrees? No. Well, you did. And 44, and 43, and 42, and 41. So why didn't you represent it with dozens of dotted sticks? Not enough time. Okay? This one has three intermediate. Okay. So, beginning, end, left the professor out. Why did you draw it with three? Three was good enough, and eight would have been time-consuming. And okay. Now, your sticks aren't dotted.
No, but they're on a dotted line.
The dotted line is the transition line. Okay. So she made two transition lines and dotted both of them to indicate that. Why did you make those lines curved? Now, watch what's happening here. This is an important part of representing movement. Okay. We do this, right? We show it. That's the way we represent motion. We show it. What does she mean? Why did she draw curved lines? Curved dotted lines. Engineer, why? The movement of the arm relative to the pivot point describes an arc. Okay. That's what you meant. Exactly. Exactly. We draw a curved line because we know that if we take any particular point on the stick, as it falls, its distance from the pivot point, or the center of the radius, is going to describe an arc. It's going to be describing a circle. If you could drop it so that it pivoted all the way around, any particular point on the stick would describe a circle. There's the arc, the direction, three intermediate stages. Did the base move over? Whose is that? Did the base move over? How many of you think the base actually moved over? I don't have a clue whether it did or not. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. We'd have to mark it here, and then I could drop it. Oh, did you see what happened? It scooted out. It actually went that way, and then came this way as it bounced. Kick. Any of you fell trees for a hobby? You know why loggers get killed? Because the butt of a cut tree is likely to kick out as the tree falls. And sometimes it kicks out far enough that you get hit. That's why when you yell timber, you run. You get out of the way, and you don't run that way. You run perpendicular. And you don't even have to yell timber. But you do want to get out of the way, especially of that kick. So he's represented it moving over. This one went way over. But nobody actually saw, I don't know the first time whether it actually kicked out that way or not. It may have to do with the way I let go of it, and I don't know. We could do that 20 times and see, but I'm not going to do it 20 times because it's an annoying sound. But once more. Okay, it kicks. Probably because the weight of the stick and its motion, for every action there's an equal and opposite. Remember that one? Something like that. I guess that applies. Okay. What is this? I did not fall over. I know who you are. What happened?
Well, I saw him fall, and so
Yeah. No, you couldn't have an egg falling. You couldn't have an egg falling because that's not the representation that you had. If I had an egg here standing up and let it go, well, then you could do that. But you didn't draw an egg, you drew a stick. You saw the stick falling. What is that? No, it's not. What kind of person is that? It's a stick figure. Of course it's a stick figure. That's a stick. That's a representation of a stick. It's called a stick figure. You have a personal relationship. Person. A personal relationship with the stick. Did you feel sorry for the stick when it hit? No. Did any of you go, ouch, when the stick hit the table? Okay. But we have a stick figure falling. And I hope not getting hurt. Okay. Is that right? Okay. My motion relative to this. Is that what you meant? From the stick's point of view. Absolutely wonderful. From the stick. From the. That's absolutely wonderful. To represent me, the horrible dropper, from the stick's point of view, okay. Okay, now, you're the stick. We want to see if she represented this accurately. So the stick goes this way. From the stick's point of view, where is the person going? You drew it correctly. You drew it correctly. You drew me from the stick's point of view. No one has ever done that. Yes! Okay. All right. And, okay, another table. No intermediate positions, an arrow pointing from the vertical to the horizontal, base pretty much at the same point. So, out of these seven, one, two, three have tables. A fourth has the surface of the table without the legs. Fifth, two do not. This one stopped. We assume that I hit the floor. Except that I wasn't falling, it's only from the sixth point of view. I'm still standing up. Did my feet move? I'm really fascinated by this one. Okay. Okay. Bottom line, what's the take-home point from this demonstration? You had an experience. You saw it visually. You drew a representation of it. You can't actually draw the event again, the whole thing. You can't do it. But there are conventions and some unconventional ways of representing graphically the event. And cartoonists and graphic artists and sign makers all know these conventions, and they differ by culture. Different cultures have different ones. What the child is doing is learning to represent the experiences that he or she has. Some of them are represented graphically, as this one was. That's what I asked you to do. Could I ask you to represent it in another way? How else could you represent it? Some of you have already done another representation. The kinesthetic representation is using your arm to represent the stick and showing the motion is a representation. It's a kinesthetic representation of the real experience of the stick falling. You might have chosen your body. Is that what you were suggesting? That if I wanted to represent the stick falling, I could just stand here and fall over. Actually, at puberty, as I grew, I increased my height, I raised my center of gravity, and when you get taller and fall, you fall farther, you have a longer period of time to accelerate, and you have greater mass. So if you compare the way I fell at 8 with the way I fell at 15, when I hit the floor at 15, I hit a lot harder. So as I went through puberty, I had to give up a trick that I had perfected when I was 6 and 7. And the trick was to stand and fall on my face. Hey, you know, it's a guy thing. And the key to it is that as you fall, just as your mother starts to scream, you raise your hands. And if you're only this high, 4 feet, less, 3.5, 3.5, you get your hands up. Your hands are just about under your center of gravity. You haven't fallen very long or very far, and you don't weigh that much. You can actually catch yourself without banging your nose. As I went through puberty, I had to give that trick up because I weighed considerably more. I was falling through a longer arc for a longer period of time, accelerating. And when the hands went up, two things happened. One is, there's not enough strength in the arms to stop the motion instantaneously. And if you don't stop the motion, you bang your face in the floor. Or if you raise your chin, you raise your face, your head, you bang your chin on the floor. And the second thing is that you jam your elbows and shoulders. You get them up because you don't have enough strength, particularly going through puberty, to do that. So representing the stick with my body isn't going to happen. That's the point of that story. But it's not going to happen because I went through puberty and I'm too big to do that now. Could you represent that event in words? Could you write a description of what you saw? Sure you could. It's called a lab report. It's your lab report. Do the thing, see the experience, see the result, describe what you did, describe the consequences, put all that in words. And why are lab reports in physics so difficult? Is you're trying to describe reality in words. And that's difficult. Could you describe it in a poem? Could you sing it? Could you create a tune? Any music ed majors? You're on the spot. Music ed? What instrument would you want to have to represent a falling stick? A slide whistle, of course. That's how falling sticks and falling other things get represented. With a slide whistle. Actually, you go this way. Would you go in or out? If you didn't have a slide whistle, you could use a trombone. Why would you choose those instruments? Or a violin? Because you can make continuous sound as the motion was continuous, and you can change the frequency or the pitch regularly, so it sounds like it's an analogy to the falling of the stick, and then you'd want to thump at the end. Program music represents real activity. How many of you could dance that stick falling? Could you dance the stick falling? Maybe. What we are developing as we go through infancy and then childhood and into adulthood is the ability to represent our experience in multiple ways. And to remember our experience in more and more complex sequences and more complex relationships. We're developing the representations that are accepted in our culture, or we're developing, and we are developing, our own unique representations of our experience and trying to communicate those. We develop language so that we can communicate our experience in a way that other people will understand. We develop the graphic arts so that we can communicate our experience, our understanding, in ways that people can understand. And we share languages with other people. We develop them as a group, whether they're graphic arts languages or musical languages, if you want to call them that, or conventions, so that we can pass our experience back and forth and compare it and think about it and figure out how it's different and think about what it means. What the infant and child and adolescent and you are doing is developing those more complex schemas with more complex ways to represent them, and we'll go on from there on Wednesday.